This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Sunday demonstrations continue for the third straight week in Washington, D.C. and around the world. The violent clashes in London led to police arresting over 100 people after thousands of self-styled patriots, backed by far-right groups, gathered in the central part of the city over the weekend. France has seen angry protests over alleged racism in the security forces over the last several days. The protests have been given additional impetus by the death in the U.S. of George Floyd, with thousands turning out in Paris Saturday for a new protest that ended with clashes against police. The Human Rights Watch said French President Emmanuel Macron should identify concrete reforms to end racism within the police. In the southeastern U.S. city of Atlanta, protesters demanding action gathered outside a fast food restaurant, one that was set on fire Saturday night, where an African-American was shot to death by a police officer the night before. Rayshard Brooks was being questioned after falling asleep in the drive-through lane. He failed a breathalyzer and then a struggle ensued, according to authorities who say he was resisting arrest. They add when he ran, police shot him. The officer has been fired and another put on an administrative leave in the case. Protesters demanding justice and systemic reforms erupted across the U.S. after George Floyd died last month. A white officer, Derek Chauvin, pressed his knee into Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes, even as Floyd said he could not breathe. The UN Human Rights Council will face many important issues when its 43rd session opens Monday. One of the highlights of the week-long meeting will be an urgent debate on institutionalized racism in the United States, underlined by the killing of George Floyd while in police custody. Geneva Director of Human Rights Watch John Fisher calls this a moment of reckoning for the U.S. The session was suspended in March because of COVID-19. From Washington, this is VOA News. Worldwide, more than 430,000 people have died from COVID-19, more than 115,000 of them in the United States. The number of confirmed infections globally is more than 7.8 million, and in the U.S., more than 2 million confirmed cases. Brazil now has the second highest number of deaths, followed by the U.K., Italy, France, and Spain. Brazil continues to have the second highest number of infections. Sunday, Iran reported over 100 new deaths in a single day from the new coronavirus for the first time in 2 months. China reported 57 new cases of the coronavirus Sunday, the highest daily figure since April, as concerns grew about a resurgence of the disease. A new cluster has been linked to a wholesale food market in South Beijing. Chinese authorities have locked down a lab and residential communities near the market, trying to stem a new outbreak of COVID-19. City officials say 45 workers at the market tested positive for the coronavirus, though they showed no symptoms. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said Sunday the country will open its borders to country in the European Union's Schengen area June 21st. That's 10 days before previously announced. One exception, Portugal, where the border will open July 1st. Austria's economy minister said Sunday the country plans extra investment subsidies and tax breaks to help companies hit by the coronavirus pandemic. Companies that commit to investments in the next 6 months could get 14% of it back as a subsidy. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said Sunday the U.S. economy, the world's largest, is now, quote, in a recovery stage from the debilitating effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The coronavirus forced the closure of thousands of businesses, even as forecasters say unemployment figures will remain high for months. Kudlow told CNN, quote, I think we are on our way back. 2021 is going to be a solid, solid year. He indicated the $600 a week unemployment compensation supplement the federal government has been paying more than 40 million unemployed workers, in addition to the state jobless benefits, is likely to end as scheduled at the end of July. Today, U.S. President Donald Trump turns 74. An incident a day earlier in which he appeared unsteady on his feet has revived questions about his health as he heads into a grueling reelection campaign. Scrutiny of a president's health often intensifies during campaigning. A widely seen video from Saturday shows President Trump walking tentatively and unsteadily down a ramp after delivering a commencement speech at West Point. He tweeted the ramp was long, steep, had no handrail, and was slippery. Since Mr. Trump has regularly mocked the health and acuity of his presumptive election opponent, Democrat Joe Biden, the question of physical fitness could weigh heavily in the campaign. Via remote, Diane Roberts, VOA News.
welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Nobody prays or wishes to be a victim, but it's from our sensitization. People get to know that, in the event that this occurs, this is what we shall do.
Nigerians condemn a sharp rise in sexual violence against women and minors.
An agreement with the transitional Sudanese government to get a commitment from the Sudanese government that they will cooperate fully with the International Criminal Court and they will hand over the already indicted criminals by the International Criminal Court to the ICC.
The Justice and Equality Movement says it hopes to sign a peace deal with the Sudanese transitional government by the end of the month.
The Speaker of the National Assembly of the United Republic of Tanzania, the last time I checked, is not the ethics tribunal, nor is he a member thereof. So there is no bar whatsoever, if you are talking about the law, to prevent me from running for the presidency of the United Republic.
And Tundu Lissu, a former Tanzanian parliamentarian, plans to challenge President John Magufuli in the upcoming general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says he is particularly upset following reports of increasing violence against women, including rape. The president has since directed the police to arrest and prosecute cases of sexual violence. Addressing the nation on Democracy Day on June 12, the president expressed his administration's commitment to use the rule of law to combat all forms of sexual violence against women and children. Meanwhile, governors have declared a state of emergency in their respective state due to the sexual violence against women and children. Rachel Adejo Andrew is the chairperson for the International Federation of Women Lawyers of FIDA, Abuja chapter. She tells me that the commitment by the president and the declaration of the state of emergency by governors aimed at ending sexual violence will help to combat the menace.
It's a step in the right direction, and it shows that more than ever before, the government is willing to fight this menace. And it's willing to fight the upsurge of domestic violence and sexual violence against women. And to show that the government is actually true and committed to the fight, the Office of the Attorney General of the Federation is putting together a committee that will be in charge of ensuring that people who are perpetrators of those acts are brought to book, they are arrested, they are investigated, and then they are prosecuted. So it is a step in the right direction. I mean, it's going to give government push to the fight that CSOs and individuals have been fighting to eliminate all forms of violence.
Ms. Adejo Andrew, there have been concerns that the police sometimes have been lackadaisical or uninterested in cases of allegations of rape or sexual violence, and that the call by the president demanding the investigation and prosecution of alleged perpetrators should be expedited. What are your views about these two assertions?
We have had challenges in getting the police to do proper, thorough investigation when it comes to cases around sexual and gender-based violence. Sometimes you have the victims, when the act occurs, find out that they would have probably washed themselves before going to the police station. And once this is done, you discover that the primary evidence is destroyed. Sometimes the victims are unable to come with concrete evidence, which will help the investigation of the police. And at other times, we also know that you have pressures from the perpetrators on the police to compromise the case. But we do know one thing, that the government has really pronounced that it is interested in these cases. We know that there definitely will be a difference going forward. Because, like I said, the committee that is being put together by the Office of Attorney General of the Federation, which will be cascaded down to the states, also consists of the police.
Talking about the states, Ms. Adejo Andrew, 36 governors have unanimously issued a statement declaring a state of emergency regarding sexual violence and its reported increases in Nigeria. What is your take about that, and will this help in the fight to combat this problem?
Yes, it will help a great deal. What it will now mean is that some of the states which have not domesticated the Violence Against Persons Prohibition Act, which is an act that has very robust provisions when it comes to sexual and gender-based violence, those states, their unanimous decision, will now be pressured to domesticate that law in their states. It now becomes relevant whether you're in Sokoto or you're in Lagos. Any of the acts of sexual gender-based violence is committed, you know that basically the provisions of the law will be the same.
Talk to me about the step-up efforts that FIDA, your organization, intends to undertake in terms of education, in terms of sensitization, so these women or victims are aware of what they can do, where they can seek help, and how their perpetrators could be punished in accordance or the full force of the law.
FIDA, in all the states of the Federation where we have branches, usually we are the hem of ensuring that, you know, lobbying around the state of assembly, of ensuring that this act passed. So we know that governors have agreed. We're going to push at the different states so that this act can be passed. And then we're going to act like a watchdog on the police. Normally what we do a lot of sensitization in states that this act has been passed already, because a lot of times people don't even know that there's an act or a law place which penalties are very stiff, and so they don't take advantage of the law. So usually, like in Abuja, for instance, we have done a lot of sensitization. We go about in different remote communities, and then we also do radio programs so that people are aware of this law. And then we collaborate with the police, because the police are the ones who investigate, and they are the ones who will either prosecute or recommend to the office of the DPP for prosecution. Once a victim reports to us, we take up the matter. We ensure that we go to the police station with them. We ensure that investigation carried out, and then prosecution is also carried out. Of course, we also have the medical angle, because once anyone who suffers any form of sexual abuse, you know, it is required by the law that you go to a government hospital, you'll be examined so that there will be a medical report in that regard. Because nobody prays or wishes to be a victim. But from our sensitization, people get to know that, oh, in the event that this occurs, this is what we should do.
Rachel Adejo Andrew is the chairperson for the International Federation of Women's Lawyers, FIDA Abuja chapter. She spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Also in Nigeria, the coalition of northern groups has expressed concern about the increasing rate of killings in the northern part of the country. The group says for the past year, it appears the north has become a battlefront between the government and the militant group Boko Haram. Coalition members cited instances of killings in Katsina, Sokoto, Zamfara, Kaduna, and Taraba states. The Coalition of Northern Groups says the Northern Elders Forum should summon a meeting of academics, cultural and religious leaders, and other stakeholders to establish a strategy to help stop the killings. Abdul Aziz Suleiman, spokesperson for the Coalition of Northern Groups, tells me that the International Criminal Court, or ICC, and the rest of the international community should be made aware of the killings in parts of the country's north and why the government appears unable to address them.
You see, what we are saying is basically that this government lacks the moral credentials to even celebrate democracy when there is no evidence of dividends of democracy on the ground. And besides, just 2-3 days back, people, citizens of Nigeria, were attacked, massacred. So I think we believe that rather than celebrating anything that doesn't even exist, Nigerians should be mourning. And this insecurity is a nationwide affair. You have these bandits almost everywhere in the country. And even the insurgency for this government came on the basis of a promise to end the insurgency in the southeast.
Abdulaziz, let me ask you this question. Officials of the administration have said that they have stepped up efforts to combat militant groups and banditry and have improved security, because that is one of the significant pledges President Muhammadu Buhari made as a military man. Nigerians repose confidence in him that he'll be able to address this, and they are addressing this. This is what the officials say. Why are you saying something different?
That is the official version, but the reality on ground is that these things still go on. Just on Wednesday this week, more than 70 people, I think it's even rising to about 100 people, were killed in Maiduguri, and in Batari, in Kasera State, about 70 people were killed. So it's the word against the reality.
But some people are saying your criticisms are politically motivated, particularly when the president enjoys enormous support in all parts of the country, but especially in the northern part. So this, they said, you are just doing this just to draw attention to your group.
No. I think that's not the reality. He does not anymore enjoy that support that he enjoyed in 2015. Even before we made our statement, there were protests in Kasina. People are grumbling all over because this insecurity is, the North appears to be under siege.
Who is putting the North under siege?
By killers, by these assailants. That's the responsibility of government to find out who they are and halt them.
Now, you are saying Nigerians should pass a vote of no confidence in the current leadership of Nigeria. Why are you saying so?
We are saying that we, our group, has passed that vote of no confidence. We're not calling on people to do it. We're not calling on Nigerians to do it. We have passed the vote of no confidence. And this is the first time. Even the Northern Elders did pass similar vote of no confidence, I think, about a month ago.
So you're also calling on the Northern Elders Forum to summon an urgent meeting of all stakeholders, including credible sections of the civil society, intellectuals, the politicians, the professionals, cultural and religious leaders, and elders to exactly do you want them to achieve? What is their objective?
We want them to come and sit and discuss the situation, come out with a unified position so we don't have to operate separately. The North should come up with a unified position. If it's going to write a letter collectively, jointly to the presidency, perhaps the presidency might not be fully aware of what is happening. I think just 2 days ago, district heads in Kasina went to the area of Kasina and told him that they were going to leave their community. They all vacated the community because their lives were under threat.
What about the governors in the North? What should they do?
You see, governors don't really have the power of security in their hands. I think they only play an advisory role and have complementary. They don't really have that power.
So give me a list of your expectations or things you want the federal government to do to address your concerns in parts of the North as well as the entire Nigeria.
I would have suggested, but though it may not be constitutional, I would have suggested the setting up of or the declaration of state of emergency in all the affected areas and giving an ultimatum for the security agents to bring all these things to a conclusive end. You know, the Southwest governors have come up with a unified regional security system, which is helping them. It's helping them. When we attempted to come up with something similar, the Northern governors kicked against it. Now you can see what's happening. Abotekun is helping the Southwest.
Abdul Aziz Suleiman is the spokesperson for the Coalition of Northern Groups. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Representatives of the Justice and Equality Movement, or JEM, say they hope to sign a peace deal with the Sudanese transitional government at the end of the month. The group says ongoing talks in the South Sudanese capital, Juba, are progressing steadily. They form part of the transitional government's efforts to bring peace, stabilize the country, and boost the prospect of establishing democracy. This, analysts believe, will help attract both domestic and foreign investments. Mutasim Andam, spokesperson for the JEM, tells me that his group is pleased with the progress of the ongoing talks with the transitional government.
As you may know, that the Sudanese peace talks in Juba, the capital of South Sudan, began since last September. We negotiated various issues like power sharing, wealth sharing, land, transitional justice, and responsibility, accountability and reconciliations, also reparations and restitutions, and many other issues related to the situation in Darfur in the two areas, especially the IDPs, internally displaced persons and refugees. We come to an agreement on most of these issues, and now we are on the final round, which is about the security arrangement. As you know, that security arrangements is the most complicated issue when you talk about peace. We almost finished about 70% of the talks, and we will finish probably during the next 7 days.
Is your group, GEM, satisfied with how negotiations are ongoing at the moment, which some people perceive as could lead to an agreement next week?
This inequality movement is very satisfied on the way that the peace talk going, and also on the conclusions of the negotiations on most issues that we negotiated with the government of Sudan. We think all issues have gotten sufficient time of negotiations, and both parties are satisfied fully by the conclusion of the negotiations.
Has the current pandemic affected negotiations so far?
Yeah, coronavirus pandemic affected the negotiations and the death of the Sudanese defense minister also, because the Sudanese government left Juba after the death of the former defense minister. And then they failed to come back due to the travel restrictions all over the world. So we have to wait for at least 2 months before we resume talks through video conference meeting or virtual meetings. And that's also prolonged the peace talk time frame that we have agreed to finish the talks within it.
Talking about the security arrangement, how genuine is the discussion and how confident are you that you'll be able to iron out all the issues that and concerns that you have before the conclusion of this agreement to be signed, hopefully, as you said, by the end of the month?
We believe that if the negotiations continue as we already witnessed, we are very confident that these talks will lead to an agreement on the security arrangement. There will be concern to some extent. However, the issues that we already tabled, telling us that all this concern could be taken in consideration, and the two parties will fully satisfy by the result of the talks.
What is GEM's reaction after reports that Ali Kushaib, who was wanted by the International Criminal Court, who is alleged to have committed gross human rights violations in Darfur, handed himself over to the authorities to face prosecution?
GEM welcomes the appearance of the criminal Ali Kushaib before the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and this is prevail for justice, as well as for the victims of Ali Kushaib. As you know, that Ali Kushaib committed crimes against humanity, war crimes, as well as genocide, him alongside with the former Sudanese president, the dictator Omar al-Bashir, and the former Sudanese defense minister Abdulrahim Ahmed Hussein, and the one of the Janjaweed leaders also called Ahmed Haroun. Those four who are the International Criminal Court issued warrant arrest against them. So this is very important development on the issue of justice. We in Juba discussed the justice issue and reached to an agreement with the transitional Sudanese government to get a commitment from the Sudanese government that they will cooperate fully with the International Criminal Court, and they will hand over the already indicted criminals by the International Criminal Court to the ICC.
Mutasim Adam is the spokesperson for the Sudanese Justice and Equality Movement, or GEM. He spoke with me from the South Sudanese capital, Juba. A former Tanzanian lawmaker announced plans to lead the main opposition party, Chadema, to challenge incumbent President John Magufuli in the upcoming October general election. The former president of the Tanganyika Law Society says his over two decades of work puts him in a prime position to defeat the president. Lisu remains abroad while receiving medical treatment following an assassination attempt nearly 3 years ago. He says the president's mismanagement and dictatorial governance style gives him the opportunity he seeks to win. Speaking with me, Tunlu Lisu explains what he says makes him uniquely qualified to defeat the president in the upcoming polls.
I think the answer is not too difficult to find. Mr. Lisu has a record of over 25 years fighting for the issues that matter to Tanzanians. Issues of justice, issues of social justice, issues of their rights, issues of their economic well-being. And Mr. Lisu has also a record of standing up for government that respects people's freedoms, people's rights, and so on and so forth. And these are the issues that have featured prominently during this past 5 years. The country has been taken apart by President Magufuli and his ways, and Mr. Lisu is eminently qualified to bring the country back on track.
Now, Mr. Lisu, you are currently outside the country, and some of your critics in Tanzania are saying, but how would he know the current situation on the ground since he's been away for over a year? What answers will you give them, even if they want to support you and vote for you in the October general election?
I have been away for 2 years and 9 months, to be exact. It's not just a year, it is 33 months now. That said, throughout this period, I have remained deeply engaged in matters Tanzanian. In every major question that has gone on in Tanzania, I have followed it very keenly, and I have pronounced myself on it. So I may be living thousands of miles away from Tanzania, but I'm communicating with Tanzania. I'm following Tanzania on a daily basis over this past 33 months. I know exactly what is going on.
All right, Mr. Lisu, what do you say to your critics who are of the view that because of the Chama Cha Mapinduzi, the ruling party's political dominance in the political climate or atmosphere in Tanzania, it's nearly impossible to defeat the incumbent President Magufuli in the October elections? What would you say to them?
It is very difficult, absolutely. But impossible, no. CCM can be defeated. And I will tell you this, Peter. CCM has destroyed its traditional constituencies. CCM has antagonized its power bases. It has no friends with the working people. The Tanzanian workers have not been given any salary increase during the last 5 years of President Magufuli's rule. The Tanzanian peasantry has had their economies almost completely run aground. If you speak of the southern farmers, for instance, they were robbed of their cashew crops outright. CCM constituency has had a very powerful constituency within the business community. Gone. Over the past 5 years, the president has run a vicious economic warfare on the business community, both a local business community as well as the international business community. Gone. President Magufuli has had no answer whatsoever to the massive problems of unemployment of our young people. So I think President Magufuli is easy to be brought down. He's there for the taking.
Now, so let me ask you this. You were a parliamentarian until certain circumstances led to your seat being declared vacant because you've not been in the country. At least that was the official.
Right.
What makes you think that a similar issue might not crop up since you are currently not in Tanzania and just a few months away from election? What makes you think that hurdles cannot be put on your way so that you are barred or prevented from challenging or contesting in the upcoming election for your party, Chadema?
I can only speak of the law as it is now and the law as I know it. If we speak about the law as it is, there is absolutely no legal bar for me to run for the presidency. I was unseated. My parliamentary seat was declared vacant ostensibly because I had missed 3 consecutive sessions of parliament. Now, everybody knows what happened to me on September 7, 2017, except the speaker. Never mind the fact that he had his office and myself were writing to each other throughout the period that we say didn't know where I was, the first ground that he used. The second, according to him, I did not comply with the asset declaration provisions of our leadership ethics law. Now, the issue here is the only institution that has exclusive jurisdiction and power to make determinations on questions of declaration of assets for public leaders is the Ethics Tribunal. Now, the Speaker of the National Assembly of the United Republic of Tanzania, the last time I checked, is not the Ethics Tribunal, nor is he a member thereof. So there is no bar whatsoever, if you're talking about the law, to prevent me from running for the presidency of the United Republic.
Tundu Lissu is a former Tanzanian parliamentarian. He spoke with me from Brussels, Belgium. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the Electoral Commission of Zambia, or ECZ, plans to meet all political parties and other stakeholders next week. The objective, officials say, is to begin the process of engagement and communication as the electoral body begins preparations for next year's general election. This after the Electoral Commission rolled out plans to organize the presidential, parliamentary and local representative elections in 2021. Patrick Nishindano, the chief electoral officer of the Electoral Commission, says organizing next year's polls will begin with a 30-day voter registration process across the Southern African country on October 18. Prospective voters, he says, are encouraged to register as the electoral body compiles a list to be used for the polls. Patrick Nshindano tells me that the Electoral Commission had to revise its original timetable for the polls due to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. He also says the revision was needed due to measures implemented to curb the spread of the disease.
I think the basic principle around the new plan is basically to try and align it with the date that is set in the Constitution, that is 12th August 2021, when the general elections will be held for Zambia. And before the COVID, we already had a scheduled timeline, which was supposed to even commence with voter registration that was slated in May this year. But of course, like everything else in the world, that was disrupted, and we had to come up with a revised timeline for undertaking that exercise. So there are quite a number of aspects that will happen, but one of the key milestones within that is, of course, the voter registration.
So talking about the revised plan, when do you plan on undertaking this voter registration list that will be used for the election? Because you need to compile the list in order for prospective voters to be allowed to vote in next year's general election. So what is the new timeline for this important compilation of the voter list?
The new register, like I earlier indicated, was supposed to be to commence in May this year. Now it has been slated for 19th October as a kickstart date, and we hope that this will run for about 31 days in total. It's going to be a national program. It's going to be spread out to all the constituencies and all the wards, and all the polling stations will be serviced. So we are pretty sure that if every citizen turn up to be able to register themselves, we should be able to capture. Our target is about 9 million for that. Looking at our population, that is basically the benchmark in terms of eligible voters. Also some enhancements that are coming to that.
Now, Patrick, you are aware that sometimes when voter registration process is underway, you have political parties and civil society groups complaining or expressing concern about issues here and there. What is the policy or the plan to address these concerns or take them along to explain the transparency process in this compilation exercise that you will undertake in October?
And I think that is a very, very critical aspect that you raise, and it's one that we recognize even in our election timetable, right up to the time we are going to conduct the polls in August 2021. As a commission, we already have established structures, first and foremost, for engaging political parties, for engaging the media, and indeed civil society organizations. So we did already engage the media on the timetable. We will be engaging the political political parties on the 16th, which is next week. We'll also be engaging non-state actors on Friday, which is the 19th of June. But this is something that will be going on. It will be a continuous process to bring them on board. But in addition to that, we're going to have very aggressive publicity and voter education that is going to kickstart next month, right up to 2021, in terms of the time for the poll. So to educate people about the voter registration exercise, but also many other processes that are in the way, including regulations that are going to be reviewed, prisons voting, which has never happened in the country, that is going to start for the first time, and indeed any other process that is going to happen. The idea is that we need to ensure that we carry our stakeholders with us.
Patrick, you are aware that Zambia is often regarded as a bastion of democracy, peace and stability. However, in the last election organized by the Electoral Commission of Zambia, the losing candidate or the losing party refused to accept the outcome of the result. What are the measures your organization plan to implement in order to ensure that there is no doubt about the winner of the upcoming election next year?
I think election acceptability remains a challenge, not just for Zambia, the continent itself, as Africa. That is something that we grapple with. All electoral management bodies do recognize that, including the Electoral Commission of Zambia. And what we're doing now, including the new voter registration exercise, where we are going to have a fresh register to ensure that first and foremost we remove all the issues that especially the opposition political parties were raising with regards to the register's integrity, which included allegations of foreigners being on the register, a number of deceased persons and so on. That is going to be cleaned up. And one way of doing that is that this time we're also introducing enhanced biometric identification system, which is going to capture 10 fingerprints, but also the portrait. But beyond that, we want to carry the stakeholders with us all the way in whatever we are doing, every process. We want to ensure that it's transparent, including the results management system, which we're going to share with them so that they're able to appreciate. I think we can only do so much on our part, and what we have come to realize that as a commission, let's do our part, let's provide that information. If the public decides to misinterpret the information and carry out a lot of misinformation, we would have done our part and ensure that the polls are transparent and indeed one that would call fair, free and credible elections at the end of the day.
Patrick Nshindano is the Chief Electoral Officer of the Electoral Commission of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. South African Dr. Kersey Digg has been on the front line treating coronavirus patients. She and her husband are outdoor enthusiasts and in normal circumstances frequently go camping and take part in annual Two Oceans Marathon, which has been cancelled this year due to the pandemic. To cope with the stress of the work and being stuck at home, the doctor decided to run her own 56 kilometers marathon nonetheless in a parking lot. She and her husband also pitched a tent in their living room where they often spend time. For VOA, Franco Puglisi reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
For South African doctors like Kersey Digg, working on Africa's front line to fight the COVID-19 pandemic brings a lot of stress. Dr. Digg admits her apprehension and fear about what the work will be for the day. Here she has more to say.
Each day when I leave for work, I leave feeling a little bit apprehensive, a little worried and terrified, not knowing what the day will have to throw at me. It has been a very emotional time. We've had to make some very difficult decisions as doctors regarding our patients, especially because of our limited resources.
As a keen runner, Dr. Digg's normal coping tools were stopped with lockdown measures and Cape Town's cancellation of the annual Two Ocean Marathon. So the doctor decided to run her own marathon, but with a route not quite as scenic as the coastal South Africa's Indian and Atlantic Oceans.
I decided to run the Two Oceans in our parking lot. It was a little bit insane, but I needed a distraction. And second of all, it was also something that when everything felt so out of control and unpredictable, I needed that something that I could achieve and that I could just put my mind to.
South Africa's lockdown has been a tough challenge for outdoor buffs. Dr. Digg and her partner, Sean Brooks.
Most weekends we were always adventuring out or going exploring or hiking or surfing or running or something like that. And so when lockdown came, it's like we had all this free time because our weekends were now forced to be inside.
The couple couldn't resist the call of spending some time camping in the newly bought camping tent. But lockdown, unfortunately, wouldn't allow it. So the couple decided to go camping in their own living area at home.
Now, of course, we couldn't go into the mountains where we'd rather be, but instead we decided to do it in our lounge. We set up our tent, we had a card game, and cooked our food on our little gas stove, and it was just magical. And then in the morning when the sun rose, we sat in our tent and watched the sunrise. And it was definitely something I will always remember from the lockdown.
The COVID-19 pandemic hasn't stopped this doctor's resolve to stay healthy and enjoy life. South Africa's lifting a ban on alcohol sales last week also had helped to lift their spirit. Franco Puglisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says lessons learned from previous outbreaks of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo and effective therapeutics will allow it to more quickly contain a new outbreak of the deadly disease in Equator Province. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
UN health officials report there is no link between the Ebola outbreak declared June 1st in Imbandaka, Equator Province, and the epidemic, which broke out nearly 2 years ago in DR Congo's North Kivu and Ituri provinces. They say the experience gained, however, and lessons learned from tackling this deadly disease in eastern DRC will help them to more quickly stop the spread of the virus in Equator Province in the western part of the country. WHO Emergency Operations Manager Michelle Yao says the World Health Organization has more than 20 staff on the ground and is ready to send in more if necessary. He tells VOA that the WHO is working with partners to set up treatment centers to monitor risks and respond promptly to identify and trace new cases.
Mentioned earlier, our objective this time is to work through local authorities. They were already trained. They had some experience. So we have just to refresh and we have to remain behind coaching them. Lesson learned remain the critical one is to work through the community.
The epidemic in eastern DRC, which has infected more than 3,460 people and killed 2,280, finally appears to be winding down. The latest reports from Western DRC, where the outbreak has just started, put the number of confirmed and probable cases at 12, including 9 deaths. 2 years ago, the same region was stricken with Ebola. It took less than 4 months to contain the outbreak with the help of an experimental vaccine which provided protection against the virus. Yao says the vaccines, which since have proven to be safe and effective, will help to speedily contain the virus. So far, he says, more than 600 people have been vaccinated in Imbandaka and Wangata health zones. He says 3,000 doses of the vaccine are in place and more are expected to be delivered soon. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's kick off with boxing. British World Heavyweight Champions Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury have agreed to a 2-fight deal, according to promoter Eddie Hearn. Talks of a historic bout for the undisputed title reportedly began in early May for what is billed as the biggest sporting event in UK since England won the World Cup. The 30-year-old Joshua holds the WBA, IBF and WBO belts, while 31-year-old Fury is the WBC champion. But Fury would first have to overcome Deontay Wilder in a third meeting. He is contracted to fight the American, from whom he won the WBC title in February. Joshua, who reclaimed his world titles in December, has to face his mandatory challenger, Bulgarian Kubrat Pulev, when the sport fully resumes after the coronavirus shutdown. In a statement, Fury's promoter, Frank Warren, said no contracts have been signed yet. In athletics, Norway's Karsten Warholm set a world record in the seldom run 300 meters hurdles as top-level athletics emerged from lockdown at the Impossible Games. 24-year-old Warholm took 0.7 seconds off the mark set by Britain's Chris Rawlinson in 2002, clocking 33.78 in Oslo. World 1500 meters champion Timothy Cheruiyot, running in Kenya, was a distant fourth. The contest was billed as a team event, with Cheruiyot leading a Kenyan quintet that also included his predecessor as world champion Elijah Manangoi. However, as the split screen video link showed, wind and rain in high altitude Nairobi was a distinct disadvantage to Cheruiyot. With many athletes unable to travel because of coronavirus restrictions, the event was set up as a Diamond League exhibition to replace the Bislett Games. Elsewhere, the Tokyo 2020 will be a simplified Olympics, according to the chief executive of the organizing committee. The games, scheduled to start in July, were postponed for a year in March because of fears over the COVID-19 pandemic. Organizers said that they are working on more than 200 ideas to simplify and reduce costs for the rescheduled games. The chief executive said the Olympics will not be done with grand splendor. He also revealed that organizers had not ruled out reducing the number of fans, although the competition's schedule remained unchanged for now. In football, South Africa marked 10 years since the 2010 World Cup on Thursday. It was June 11, 2010 that the World Cup kicked off at Soccer City in Johannesburg, with the host nation taking on Mexico. The game ended in a 1-1 draw before South Africa suffered a defeat to Uruguay. And even though they beat France in their last group game, Bafana Bafana became the first World Cup hosts to fail to advance past the first round. It was left to Ghana to fly the flag for the continent, becoming only the third African team after Cameroon in 1990 and Senegal in 2002 to reach the quarterfinals. Then the Black Stars were controversially denied progress to the semi-final when Luis Suarez handled a goal-bound ball, got sent off, and then watched from the tunnel as Asamoah Gyan missed the subsequent penalty. 10 years on, South Africa and the rest of the continent are proud of the accomplishment of hosting the event for the only time in African history. But things have not improved since then for the African teams in the World Cup. In 2014, Algeria and Nigeria made it to the second round, but in Russia in 2018, all African teams dropped out in the first round. Finally, Tanzania Premier League will become the second after Burundi to restart after 3 months stoppage due to COVID-19. After the government okayed for sporting activities resume, the Tanzania Football Federation has drafted out fixtures for the remaining 10 rounds of matches. TFF has issued guidelines to fans and players to prevent a possible spike in infections. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
tell them, blaze them. Look at you in that dress. Girl, you dangerous like a gun. Give them you, nothing less. Girl, you murder everyone. Your love is a killer. Your love is a killer. Hey, look at you.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you are peeling granuts for a blind man, you must keep whistling so he knows you are not eating them. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.